So thank you and good afternoon. My talk is entitled A Randomized Controlled Trial of the Effects of Parent Mentors on Ensuring Uninsured Minority Children. And I want to thank all of my wonderful team members and NICHD for funding this research with an R01. I have nothing to disclose. So 4.8 million U.S. children, or 6%, are uninsured. And 62 to 72% of uninsured U.S. children, so that's up to 3.5 million, are eligible for but not enrolled in Medicaid or CHIP. And major racial and ethnic disparities exist. So only 5% of white children are uninsured versus 8% of African American and 12% of Latino children. But not enough is known about the most effective ways to ensure uninsured children, and no study has examined the effectiveness of parent mentors, which I'll refer to as PMs. So the study aim was to conduct a randomized controlled trial of the effects of PMs on ensuring uninsured minority children. The methods were as follows. This was a randomized controlled trial. It's called Kids Help, which stands for Kids Health Insurance by Educating Lots of Parents. My teen daughter came up with that one. And uninsured, Medicaid, and CHIP eligible Latino and African American children were recruited at community sites and randomized to the PMs or to the control group. And subjects in both groups were contacted monthly by blinded research assistants to monitor outcomes for 1 year, and additional participants were followed up for up to 2 years after the trial ceased. The setting was the seven Dallas communities with the highest proportion of uninsured and poor minority children, and recruitment occurred at 97 community sites, including supermarkets, department stores, libraries, Goodwill stores, food banks, health fairs, churches, schools, and housing projects. And the slide there just gives you some idea of the richness of the community partners. So in terms of the intervention, PMs or minority parents from a primary care clinic already had Medicaid or CHIP-covered children. These PMs underwent a two-day training session addressing types of insurance programs, the application process, completing and submitting applications with the parents, being a family liaison and advocate with the Medicaid and CHIP programs, renewing coverage, obtaining pediatric care, and helping families with food, clothing, and other social needs. PMs met with families in their homes and at community sites and contacted them regularly via phone, emails, and texting, and controls received Texas's traditional Medicaid and CHIP outreach enrollment. The outcomes assessed monthly included the proportion of children obtaining health insurance, the time interval to obtain insurance, coverage renewal, access to medical and dental care, out-of-pocket cost of care, and family financial burden, parental satisfaction, and quality of care. We used 82-item baseline and 67-item 12-month and long-term questionnaires derived from national surveys and published studies, and a cost-effectiveness analysis was performed. The results were as follows in terms of the participant flow diagram. You can see that over 49,000 potential caregivers were assessed for eligibility. 49,032 were excluded because they already were covered by Medicaid and CHIP private insurance, didn't meet the inclusion criteria or had other reasons, giving us 329 who underwent randomization, 172 to the intervention group, 157 to the control group. And then after you dealt with exclusions due to change of eligibility, loss of follow-up and withdrawal, we ended up with 123 in the intervention group, 114 in the control group in the population that could be evaluated and underwent primary analysis at the 12-month follow-up. In terms of participant baseline socio-demographic characteristics, in the first column you see the characteristic, in the second and third column you see the means or proportions for the control group and PM group respectively. The mean child age was about the same, 7.5. You can see there was some imbalance in female ethnicity, female gender with 59% in the PM group, 41% in the control group. We controlled for that later on with multivariable analysis. You can see that about two-thirds of the participants were Latino, a third were African-American, and then you can see there were low levels of educational attainment. We had about a third of parents not high school graduates, and there was a lot of unemployment, about three-quarters in each group. You can see this is a poor group with the annual family income about $21,000 to $22,000, and then the mean months insured was about 11 to 17, and some of the kids were uninsured for up to 11 years. In terms of obtaining health insurance, a significantly higher proportion of the PM group obtained health insurance versus the control group at 95% versus 68%, which is highly statistically significant. The PM group had significantly higher adjusted relative risk at about 1.3 and odds 2.9 of insurance coverage. That's after we adjusted for the child's age, the gender imbalance we mentioned earlier, parental citizenship, unemployment, and then family income. This slide shows the adjusted propensity curve. So on your y-axis is the percent insured, your x-axis the time to insurance, pink square is intervention, and then your diamonds are control. And what you see is a market sustained difference between the groups in obtaining insurance occurring about 100 days and it's sustained throughout. In terms of time to coverage, renewal rates, and long-term coverage, in this slide, the first column is the outcome, and then the second column are the median or means, and then proportions for controls in the PM group, and the final column is the p-value. All these comparisons are statistically significant, and you can see that the PM group had a significantly quicker time to getting insurance, a median of 62 days versus 140. You can see that many more of them renewed their insurance, 85% versus 60%. The two-year coverage rate was 95% versus 76%, and the three-year coverage rate was 100% versus 76%. In terms of access to care, you can see that the control group was much more likely to have no PCP, 39 versus 15%, no usual source of preventive care, 7 versus 1%, different sources for sick and preventive care, 27 versus 15%, never or sometimes gets immediate care from their PCP, 19 versus 0%, and problems getting care from specialists, 46% versus 11%. In terms of unmet needs for medical and dental care, you can see that controls are much more likely to have unmet needs overall at 25 versus 13%, preventive care 22 versus 4%, acute care 20 versus 3%, and then dental care 31 versus 18%. In terms of out-of-pocket cost of care, this slide shows the health services in the first column and then second and third columns are the mean out-of-pocket cost plus standard error for controls and PM group respectively. Final column is the p-value, and you can see that the mean out-of-pocket costs were significantly higher for all doctor visits for controls versus PMs, $37 versus $33, sick visits, $43 versus $9, and then the other findings are not statistically significant, all trending in the right direction. The slide shows parental satisfaction with the process of obtaining insurance, and that's whether or not the child ended up getting the insurance. Y-axis is a percent, x-axis are the five different Likert scale categories that parents could choose: very satisfied, satisfied, uncertain, dissatisfied, and very dissatisfied. You have the orange is control group and the pink PM intervention group, and you can see that the PM intervention group parents were much more likely to be very satisfied at 57 versus 25%, and much less likely to be dissatisfied at 4 versus 9% and 2 versus 12%. In terms of satisfaction with care, quality, and family financial burden, you can see that a significantly higher proportion of control group parents wouldn't recommend their child's health care provider or friend at 16 versus 6%, reported that the doctor never or sometimes respects you or the expert on the child, 23 versus 11%. The mean overall quality score for the child's child care visit, that's a 0-10 scale, with 10 being the best, was 8.6 for controls, 8.9 for the PM group, and then reporting that they needed additional income to cover the child's medical expenses, 13% versus 6%. In terms of intervention costs, here you have the item and then the mean monthly cost per participant. You can see the parent mentor stipends were the most costly item at about $33 mean monthly cost per participant, followed by personnel, PM travel costs, one-time supplies, two-day training sessions, and PM meetings gave us a total overall cost of about $53 per participant per month. In terms of the cost effectiveness analysis, in this slide you see the expense followed by the controls in the PM group. And you can see, of course, that the PM group had a lot of expenses for the PM and program coordinator costs, but in terms of ED visits, slightly more for controls, 62 versus about 60,000, hospitalizations about 81,000 versus 58,000, ICU stays over 277,000 versus about 75,000, and then lots of wage loss and other costs of parents who missed work days due to the child's illness at about 34,000 versus 13,000. The total overall costs were about 454,647 for the controls, a little bit over 291,000 for the PM group. When you do an incremental cost effectiveness ratio per child insured, you come up with a savings for the intervention of over $6,000 per insured child. So we concluded that PMs are significantly more effective than traditional Medicaid and CHIP outreach and enrollment in insuring uninsured minority children, obtaining insurance faster, renewing coverage, improving access to medical and dental care, reducing unmet needs and out-of-pocket costs of care, achieving parental satisfaction and quality of care, and teaching parents to maintain children's coverage up to 2 years after the intervention cessation. NPMs are relatively inexpensive at $53 per child per month, but highly cost-effective, saving over $6,000 per child insured. Implications include, given that 3.5 million U.S. children are uninsured and Medicaid CHIP eligible and 57% are Latino or African American, the findings suggest that implementing PMs nationally for minority children could potentially save over $11.9 billion. And if the PM intervention is shown to be effective for all racial and ethnic groups, the findings suggest that implementing PMs nationally for all uninsured children could save $21.2 billion. Finally, PMs and analogous peer mentors for adults in the ACA could prove to be highly cost-effective interventions for eliminating disparities and ensuring all Americans. Thank you.
I don't know if we should bow or what. I'm sorry, I'm just sitting here reeling with those numbers.
Thank you so much, all the panelists. So at this time, we would be happy to accept questions from the audience or questions among the panelists if you would like to query each other's work. Anyone with a question from the audience?
Sure. So the question was, were there significant differences when you looked at the two different racial ethnic groups, Latinos or African Americans? No, actually the intervention was effective in both. We obviously had a smaller sample size for African Americans, so some of the comparisons weren't statistically stable, but overall, yes, it was effective for both groups.
The question is, did I measure a difference in the demand for service? That's a great question. And I actually had a slide that I took out that tries to get at your question. It wasn't measured directly in this work, but of course, you have to think about it as demand relative to what's available on the ground and how much unmet need still exists. And there was a really interesting study a couple years ago by Leighton Koo and colleagues that tried to actually measure at the state level at least how much capacity there is to accommodate the growing numbers of uninsured, and there are huge differences across states. I actually haven't seen any work done at the community level, and what clinics like to say about themselves is if you've seen one free clinic, you've seen one free clinic. And that's to convey that everything is local. And so even the state level feels too big to me. That's a really important dimension to the issue of whether or not do we need more free and charitable clinics or not. And I'm not sure I can answer it with the work that we have, but some way I want to try to factor that in. It's a great question.
So the question was, how do we involve our parents to work well with the study plan? You're referring to the parent mentors?
Yes.
Yeah, so I think one of the most important factors was we were very selective. I had a colleague on my team, Dr. Mike Lee, who had worked in our clinic for decades, and he knew the parents very well, and we screened them to see if they were interested in helping others and where they were motivated and also well-organized. And then we did the training sessions where we not only focused on how you do outreach and enrollment, but being health literate, so how you, for example, get a PCP and how you get specialty care and, you know, keeping track of your child's appointments. And so we think that it wasn't just getting them insurance, but then teaching them how to use it. And there's been some pushback about the ACA because a lot of people get the insurance and they don't know what to do and how to choose providers. And so I think, exactly, so they had a navigator role, if you will, of educating parents how to navigate the system for their kids.
Was this through workshops or one-on-one, or was this through webinars, or how did you get that done?
So we had in-person training sessions. We also tested them pre and post, and then over time, we would meet with them and make sure that they were understanding things, and also if they had any challenges, we would work with them one-on-one.
Better than the parents.
Right? Yes, they were. So that we think that's sort of a really nice benefit of they're helping insure other kids who are uninsured. The kids are getting insured, and we're putting money into neighborhoods that need the money, and the parents are getting employment.
Yes. I found, remember, there's obviously lots of groups have historical trauma, but if you consider the Native Americans related to historical trauma and vaccination, since we all know the stories about the blanket impregnated smallpox gifts and things like that. So there's always some mistrust, and one of the biggest things I found in this population still, even this day, even now, is that there is historical and current mistrust of medical care. And you know, because it's only been in the last 150 years that the land, if you consider all the land we're standing on, was Native American land. And we only have 5.2 million identified federal tribes now in the United States, and we took everything away from them, everything. And if we think about the indigenous population in any other area, the way we came in and ravaged the land and took it. Not we, as that's a cultural we, but that is what it's viewed as. In fact, I did a study with the Pokagon Potawatomi on access to care when they receive federal acknowledgement. One of the things I found out, I'm a women's health nurse practitioner and I'm all about reproductive health and everything, and one of the things I asked about questions related to birth control and different kinds of aspects of care with that, and I had several women say to me, we consider the aspect of birth control as a type of genocide. Yes. And I never, in my mind, I mean, I'm from a small rural area in Indiana, and I never ever thought of anything like that. But if you talk to a culture, they consider that birth control is a way that the white man is controlling their growth factor. So, and I never, it was an aspect in all the years of doing labor and delivery and reproductive health with many different populations and things like that, that Native Americans didn't know. And honestly, for example, in Indiana, one other thing I'd like to say is when I did the interviews and things like that and I told people the study I was doing, they said, I didn't know we had Indians in Indiana. You know, it's like people, seriously, this is what people in the general population, they're an invisible group. We have 0.4% in Indiana, but it's amazing that they're sort of a forgotten group unless they're in tribal lands, and that's the truth.
Do you encounter Native Indians who are in the medical field or in the nursing field who are instrumental in spreading information?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. In fact, I've got some work that I'm going to be doing with. There is a Native American dental group, and they're wanting to partner with me when we get our funding to start doing screenings and things like that with Native groups. So there are different Native American medical and dental and nursing groups that are being built up on that. Right, right, right.
I have a question though, specific to the STI grant
question. Uh-huh. They really, I will tell you, I'm sorry, let me get up. Sure. The question was there a difference in the STI screening with males, females, and two-spirits? The males and females were pretty much the same on how they would respond. The HIV testing with the two spirits I felt was much more open. And that was one of the things that we found with the elders, because the last few years the elders at the powwow circuit that were doing all these different kinds of things did not want HIV testing there. And it's still a little bit taboo. Obviously we wouldn't get results at the powwows and things like that, but testing and screening. But they're willing to be tested for STIs, especially when I shared with some of the elders some of the statistics that just came out in the 2014 guidelines on CDC on STI infections in the native lands. And you have to remember there's migration patterns. So just because it's in Arizona or those other areas, it doesn't mean that it doesn't come in the Indiana population too, because people move back and forth. You know, the states are not, there's like semi-permeable membranes. They keep moving along. That answer your question?
Question, Mahana. Mm-hmm. What were some of the challenges you had working in your study with your group, and how were you able to overcome? Maybe just one or two.
So the question was about the kind of challenges that I have in studying racial disparities. Excuse me. It's hard to disentangle the effects of social network, really. So amongst each race ethnicity group. So there must be pathway of people receiving the information about dialysis facility and the quality of dialysis facility. So there is a website patients that can check the quality of the facility. But if they don't know that, it's really hard to be circulated, right? Also, it's really interesting to see that compared to African Americans, we see that Hispanics are more likely to receive their dialysis services at high quality facilities. Without actually doing qualitative work, interviewing those patients, why they decide to go to high quality facility versus low quality, do they have informed or do they know about that? How did they get the information, or some kind of facility characteristics such as number of staff or, you know, race, ethnicity of physicians there are making them more comfortable going to those kind of facilities. Like those kind of information are very detailed oriented by interviewing and qualitative work, and that's one of the challenges we have. Those kind of detailed information may help us disentangle what's actually underlying mechanisms of racial disparity in access to healthcare.
Did the quality of their health insurance matter in making the choices also for going to the dialysis center?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part. Quality of?
Did their insurance make a difference, whether they had insurance, whether they were not insured?
Mm-hmm.
Was that part of the study?
I took out slides of the whole table where we show the impact of insurance status of patients characterized by Medicaid, Medicare, other insurance and uninsured. We see that there's a small effect of Medicaid, but not necessarily other insurance status. So again, like it might be the case where missing cases of health insurance information might play in statistics, but that's our next plan to dig into how we can actually answer the impact of insurance status on healthcare access.
Thank you.
Yep.
They're not eligible for Medicaid.
I see.
Or Medicare. But they do receive insurance through the hospital's ability to provide insurance for those clients. But here's the big problem.
All right.
The problem is because they're undocumented, it's very expensive. They only get dialysis twice a week, so the level of the quality of the care is not the same compared to if you get insurance, which they would get dialysis 3 times a week. So that's a huge problem, and it's a problem for them because no other hospital will accept them for dialysis because they're on dialysis. The home health hospital does, but they're not giving them the same level of care as they would someone who has an issue. And so that's a huge concern because we have a significant and documented population. How do we address the inequities that's taking place? So your data may be skewed for your own looking at the Hispanic that have insurance, those who do not have insurance.
Right.
And I'd be very concerned about those.
So my co-author here, who's in this room, we actually talked about where those missing cases of health insurance information came from. Maybe that's from undocumented population where they don't know what to answer on that form. So we're actually thinking about collapsing uninsured population with missing cases and then throw them in the regressions to see whether there's any effect of those populations. But again, it's very important concern, and then we definitely need to address that. But it's really hard to distingle. But you know, I'm open to any suggestion about how we can address that concern. That's the comment.
Any more questions? Yeah.
One more,
the question was how open I am to sharing data. I think because this data set is quite small, that we wouldn't have sufficient numbers to be able to show what the story truly is in Indiana. But I'm actually undertaking a national survey of a census of free and charitable clinics. So I will have a lot more data at the state level to work with to be able to tease out at a state level what the trends are post Affordable Care Act. So stay tuned.
I want to thank all the speakers on the panel today. It's wonderful to be able to come together and share. Hold a minute. I hope you'll be able to reach out to larger communities. This is one of the opportunities with the largest audiences. Of course, when you publish, you can expand your horizons as well. But I really appreciate being here with you and sharing with our audience. And do enjoy the rest of the APHA conference. Thank you, everyone, the audience. Thank you.